You're listening to the Prepper Recon Podcast. For questions, comments, and podcast archives, go to PrepperRecon.com. I've personally been buying gold and silver from JM Bullion for over 2 years. They offer the best prices over spot that I can find, and I've never had a problem with an order. If you're looking to trade in some of your fiat paper for real money, check out JMBullion.com today. Today's guest is Paul Munson from Son Oven International. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Oh, good to be with you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. So summer's right around the corner. What prepper projects do you have lined up this year? I know you've got a big orchard. Is there a lot of maintenance on that? Or is that kind of a maintenance-free thing?
Well, there's really not a lot of maintenance, but unfortunately, when this is our third year on the property, and the previous owner had let the trees get really tall, so each year I'm trying to lower them. So I've still got quite a bit to do in just cutting the trees so they're smaller. The trees were close to 40 feet tall and couldn't spray and couldn't do anything. So we've been getting them down now to where they're less than 15 feet so we can get to everything. So I've still got a little bit of prepping work to do to get the orchard ready.
And you've got what? You've got apples, pears, what all types
we've
of trees?
We've got quite a few cherry trees, and then we've also got a section where next to what we do are growing a lot of grapes, and so we've got a number of different fruit trees as well as a pretty good-sized garden. We've got a large squash garden where we do a lot of squash, and then a vegetable garden, and so we have my wife is the one who keeps up with most of that, but what we're trying to do is grow as much of our own food as possible. We just actually within the last few weeks started an indoor grow tower so that we'll be able to, it's just the two of us at home now, so we're going to pretty much be able to year-round grow our own. We're in Illinois, so our winters are pretty harsh, but I've got a porch area that's heated that's got good light, and we're going to actually use a grow tower to do our vegetables year-round as well.
So. Well, that's just really fantastic. And fruit trees, that's one of those things that it takes a little while for them to start giving, but once they get going, that's something that you just keep getting with sort of minimal maintenance. You know, it's not quite as intense as doing a garden every year as far as to get them to produce. Once they're going, they just kind of keep going. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, they really do a nice job, and we're really excited about, again, being able to have lettuce. And we do a lot of herbs, and both indoors and outdoors, so we're actually starting our herbs for the outdoors in that grow tower, and then we're going to be able to move it outside. So we're sort of using it like a greenhouse in one sense, and then we're going to year-round trying to. And one of the nice things is that we're in the middle of cornfields. I mean, my nearest neighbor is on one side. I've got a neighbor that's a half mile away, the other mile and a half away, and behind me I think it's close to 3 miles, but much of it gets planted with sweet corn, and the farmers say help herself, so we have access to unlimited amounts of sweet corn during the season, so we're able to freeze and can a lot of that, and we're still eating stuff that we did last year, so it works out really well to not have to buy much of our own fruits and vegetables.
Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about today, Paul, was this issue of America's crumbling infrastructure. I suppose the Orville Dam is sort of the poster child for that problem. What potential risks do you see that we could have from our decrepit infrastructure?
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize in cities is that, if you look at dams around major cities and areas, that if a dam does break, the flooding can be incredible. And a great deal of our electricity and telephone lines and computer lines and things are underground, and the flooding of that can create the kind of damage that can take, months, if not years, to put things back together. So when you look at the risk from dams with flooding, it's pretty significant. And in many, many areas of the country. I mean, we're about 60 miles from Chicago, but in the 90s, it was a time when someone just was working on the Chicago River and pierced through something that flooded downtown Chicago and literally shut the city down for 2 full weeks. And it was more than 6 weeks before several people, you know, hundreds of people got back their computer, and then they weren't using computers like they do now, but computer lines and phone lines. So a lot of the underground things that get affected by flooding are significant that would affect the ability to have electricity and communications, and that could fall apart relatively easily, as well as when you look at so much crumbling with so many of the bridges and different things and realize the effects that can have on commutes that people have, as well as, you know, there's a good possibility that a few of the wrong bridges went out in a metropolitan area at the same time, that some people really wouldn't be able to work for a long period of time. So there's a lot of little things that people don't necessarily think about when it comes to the crumbling infrastructure related to how it could create disruptions in things that we just take for granted.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
In the Days of Elijah, Book 2, Wormwood, by best-selling author Mark Goodwin. Everett and Courtney Carl have survived the Seven Seal Judgments, which devastated the planet. But have their efforts to stay alive been in vain? The next series of judgments to fall upon the earth are known as the Seven Trumpets. Within this series of cataclysms is the earth's collision with a giant asteroid known as Wormwood. The comet will poison much of the planet's fresh water supplies, making survival nearly impossible. With each subsequent trumpet judgment, their odds of living grow slimmer. If Everett and Courtney are to survive, they'll need perseverance, faith, and a great outpouring of providence from the Almighty. Buy your copy of The Days of Elijah, Book 2, Wormwood, in paperback, Kindle, or audio edition from Amazon.com today.
And another thing that we don't think about with flooding is that it will typically get into the septic systems and sewer systems and wash out a lot of that raw sewage. And now all of your water that was previously somewhat potable water is now completely contaminated. And so that's a risk I think that folks forget about with flooding.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, is that, water contamination is one of the easiest things to occur and one of the hardest things to resolve. I mean, sewage can get into a water system and they might fix the problem quickly, but the contamination of the water, for that to cycle through, can be a long period of time, and the ability to even know that you've got safe water can be a major issue, due to the flooding. So that's an excellent point.
You mentioned crumbling bridges, and if that's something that we were to have in conjunction with a major disaster like a flood or a hurricane or an earthquake, it really, really slows down the recovery speed. And that's what we saw with the Orville Dam, is that under normal circumstances, it was doing okay. It's just that the age that it was and the problems that it was already having, the structural issues, they didn't really manifest until they had those record rainfalls. And then that's when that extra stress was put on that failing system. It just can't handle it. And so that's the type of thing that we could see multiple bridges go down in a single metropolitan area, because, you think, oh, well, they would never both go at the same time. Well, what if there was a flood? What if there was an earthquake? Or what if there was some other type of natural disaster, a hurricane or something, that puts that added stress on that failing infrastructure? And then that's when you get the problem, when you're least prepared to handle it. And unfortunately, that's sort of how these things happen, isn't it?
Yeah, no, very much so. I mean, one thing affects another, and it wouldn't take much in many areas that to isolate them. A lot of the metropolitan areas, when it affects commuting. I mean, if you recall, you know, on September 11th, 2001, and you saw the devastation at the towers, but then I have relatives that live in New Jersey that, you know, it took them 7 or 8 hours to walk home because the tunnels weren't accessible and they weren't, you know, allowing cars on the bridges. Just think about the tunnels being wiped out with a flood and then a couple big bridges being damaged, and people in New York would literally be stuck, and so many people commute in and out of the city every day. It could be a huge issue. And in Chicago, where I grew up, you could have a similar situation. You've got pretty much bridges with rivers that surround the downtown area, and a few of those going out could make a major issue. And if the subways flooded and shut down, I don't even know what would happen to an area, you know, metropolitan area. And I'm sure there's many other metropolitan areas that could be affected the same way.
Then the ongoing risk that we have in our infrastructure is our electrical grid. It's at risk from coronal mass ejection. It's at risk from EMP attacks or hacking attacks. And then there's also the possibility of just a straight-up physical assault against just a certain key number of power stations or reduction stations or transformer stations that could cripple the entire grid. And most metropolitan areas, they just don't function well during prolonged power outages. And I think that folks are sort of feeling this Trumpphoria, and they're forgetting about a lot of these ongoing types of risks. And it's when times are good that you should be preparing for these types of disasters. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, we've been working with emergency preparedness now for 19 years. We went through Y2K and all the fear before it and the things afterwards. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, when it came to, you know, setting things aside, we realized that, okay, maybe Y2K wasn't all it was cracked up to be, but that's when we started prepping, and we've continued ever since. And when having the good times and the good years, when we do have a little bit of extra, we always put more aside. And it's something that, yes, at the moment, maybe people feel kind of a sense of relief. And I understand that there's a prepping fatigue that sometimes comes into, you know, where you just kind of feel overwhelmed. I know I need so much stuff, and I got to get it all. And how do I get it all, and what do I do? And so when you get a chance to take a breather, a lot of people like to do that. But the idea is maybe you don't have to feel the pressure and the fear. But having a logical plan of what you want to do and making progress with it week by week and month by month, regardless of what the events are that are going around you, just is a good common sense approach, because we know there will be times when we're going to need our preppings, the things that we set aside, and there's other times when we may not be as concerned with it. But either way, always continuing down that journey of being better prepared is something that you're never going to regret doing that, and you'll be thanking yourself for doing that at some point in the future.
I remember we tried to buy our potassium iodine tablets like the day after Fukushima, and I waited, I think, 8 months for them to show up. I remember back prior to the Shemitah, you had a pretty good wait with your company. If somebody wanted to order a sun oven at that point, they could be waiting 2 or 3 months for one at that.
Got to that level. I mean, we normally, we prided ourselves on shipping within 2 working days, and we did get to the point where we had a 3-week backlog, and for us that was huge. But we have an unusual way of making solar ovens. I mean, we make the sun ovens because we do so much work internationally. We set up assembly plants for making sun ovens in developing countries. We have a system that we can increase our production relatively quickly and then shrink it when the demand isn't there. And so we went from, you know, in 2015, when all of those things were going on, and people were concerned about that and the blood moons and some of the other things that people were concerned about. We went from having 5 people making ovens to, at one point, we had 29 people making ovens, and we still, even with that, wound up with the lead times stretching out 3 weeks, which for us is huge. I know many other people got into months that they were in a backlog, and we were fortunate to be able to adjust to not quite get to that level when it came to the ovens during that peak time. And but we're doing the same thing as a business. We realize right now that because people are taking a breather from preparedness, the sales of people aren't necessarily getting the things that they were before, but we're actually doing the same thing and being prepared by setting aside an inventory to be able to be ready for the next spike, so that when it comes, we won't be hit quite as badly as we have been at other times, when suddenly the market just suddenly surges and everybody's thinking about, hey, I've got to be prepared right now.
And do you think that those are still founded concerns, the coronal mass ejection, EMP, hacking attacks, and physical assaults against the electrical grid? That's still a risk, right?
I think it's a real risk, and I know that many of us feel much better about the steps the government's taking against terrorism, but terrorism's a real risk. I mean, there are a lot of risks that are out there that people don't necessarily, you know, they don't just come and go. Sometimes people think, well, now there's no risk, we don't have to worry about it, but the reality is, yes, the government is taking much better steps towards trying to filter out terrorists, but it's still not foolproof. We are going to build a wall with Mexico that will not just stop illegal aliens coming in from Mexico. There's illegal aliens from all over the world that filter through Mexico and use that same system to get in the United States. So whether it's going to be a man-made terrorist type of attack or an act of nature, just, you know, being prepared as a lifestyle makes perfect sense. And is very biblical, and it really is something that when people don't do, at some point in the future they're going to regret. Not that it has to always be done in the sense of a panic, like sometimes when people are looking at something and they feel they have to have it right now, but more to have a good, solid preparedness plan and take a certain percentage of your discretionary income and set it aside for items that you'll use in the future is just a very common sense approach to prepping that I think people should be taking. And we practice, my wife and I practice that. We've continued, as I said, we've been doing it since we started in 1998. So next year, I guess, will be, you know, or this year will be 20 years since we started our journey on that. And I look back at things that I see in my storage that, you know, I bought 19 years ago, and I'm really, really glad I have, even some of which I've never taken out of the box, others of which we use all the time. And, you know, when it comes to prepping, too, I hope that people, when they buy their prepping, their preparedness foods, if they're buying any kind of prepackaged preparedness foods, that they're cooking them and tasting them. I mean, we have a policy when it comes to our preparedness foods that my wife cooks everything we buy, so we know if it fits our taste. If it's not going to fit our taste, then we need to get freeze-dried spices and herbs and other things that we can then use to put into the food to make it so that when we're ready to consume it, it's going to fit our taste. I know a lot of people just buy preparedness foods, put them on the shelf, and then hope they never need to use them. But if you don't taste them and you don't know how it fits, and if you really don't know the portions that are correct for your family, you may be less prepared than you think you are, and that can be dangerous too. So we rotate our preparedness foods. We've got my wife's got a whole system of managing and organizing, and, you know, keeps notes on what she's cooked and what she wants to add to it later, so that if we're living with our preparedness foods, we're going to enjoy them as opposed to looking at eating as being something that maybe we can survive with. And that does make a big difference.
That's the end of the first half of my interview with Paul Munson from Sun Oven International. Tune in next week for the rest of the show. ReadyMade Resources has a limited number of PVS 30 night vision scopes for $4,700. These are the top-of-the-line night vision scopes used by the U.S. military, which normally sell for over $11,000. Turn your 12-hour rifle into a 24-hour rifle. Visit ReadyMade Resources to get your PVS 30 today.